Welcome to the Business and Leadership Channel. My name is Michelle Boulay, and I'm so honored to be a sponsor here at this amazing conference because it's my passion to help you connect to your own inner leader and let that transform the businesses and relationships you create. I'm a life coach and healer and an internationally recognized award-winning dance artist. And dancing taught me to listen to my own inner voice and let that guide me to my success. A very common thing that happens for business owners, creatives, and leaders is that you're so close to your next goal or breakthrough and then you stop. Doubt kicks in, worry, procrastination, fear, overwhelm, which kill growth in your business and creative process. So I'm giving a talk here on Saturday, October 24th, where you'll learn tools so that you can show up with clarity and belief in yourself and your ideas, consistency to keep showing up, and the embodied and intellectual understanding to move you gracefully through the challenges you'll meet as you grow, as you go for your goals. If you can't make it live, pick up your phone now, go to Instagram or Facebook, find me, follow me, and DM me the word success, and I'll send you the free resource I'll be sharing at my presentation. It's also in the show notes. However, I do recommend you attend live here or at my main stage presentation to get the full scope of what I'll be sharing to help you realize your creative dreams. And now, please enjoy this next presentation.
Tonight, we have a panel on meditation, mindfulness, and leadership. And I have the pleasure to receive Paul Sugar, Sheila Pierce, Fleet Mole, and Miles Kessler. So Sheila Pierce has been a community leader in a multitude of environments, including university, counseling, and diverse sectors of the art and education, and direction of meditation retreats and award-winning films and cultural series. She holds a leadership position in association and humanitarian boards, including the Global Bridge Foundation, and she's a licensed integrative psychotherapist and interfaith minister. Welcome, Sheila. We also have a Fleet Mole. Fleet is a social entrepreneur, consultant, and trainer, and meditation and embodiment teacher. He is also a developer of neurosomatic mindfulness and author of Radical Responsibility. He has trained prisoners, business leaders, correctional officers, law enforcement, and other public safety professionals, as well as the general public in mindfulness-based and embodied approaches to wellness, resiliency, self-regulation, leadership, and human optimization. Welcome, Cliff. Paul Sugar. So Paul is the founder and director of the Scottsdale Institute for Health and Medicine Center for Mindfulness. He has more than 25 years of experience and has been trained with John Kabat-Zinn on MBSR. And he's a mentor of MBSR certification at the University of California, San Diego, and in Toronto. He's also teach mindfulness-based relapse prevention for addictive behavior. He has taught mindfulness in the healthcare, business, schools, sport, and private sectors. Welcome, Paul. And last but not least, Miles Kessler. Miles is a teacher of Aikido, Sixth Dan, meditation, and integral practice, and the founder of the Integral Dojo. He has a dual lineage of Burmese Mahasi tradition of meditation and the Iwa, that's really hard, Max. Iwama tradition of Aikido. He has spent 3 years on intensive Vipassana meditation retreat in Burma and Nepal. He is an innovative teacher, having created and developed several online trainings such as Meditation Discovery Cycles and the Mindfulness Meditation Teacher Certification Program. Welcome, Miles.
Thank you.
So today's panel is basically to a little bit go back to basic. The idea is for leaders, people working in leadership position, to understand a little bit what is meditation, mindfulness, and what is it for? What would be useful there? So my first question is really basic one, but if we cannot really explain in a simple way, what's the difference between mindfulness and meditation? I will start with you, Miles. You have the mic open. How would you explain it to a 3 years old?
3-year-old. Let's speak a little bit.
Or let's say maybe your
I hope.
Or maybe like, I usually say to my mother-in-law, how you would explain that to my mother-in-law.
Sure. Well, I mean, mindfulness is certainly a component of meditation. I mean, there's different types of meditation, mindfulness meditation. A mindfulness-based meditation is one of them. But meditation, you know, mindfulness is kind of, you know, the basic quality of mindfulness is to be aware, present, to cognize, to know what's happening in this present moment. And the quality is that it deepens, the knowing deepens. Wherever you place your attention, internally, externally, relationally, situationally, your knowing just kind of sinks. That's the basic quality of mindfulness. Meditation, you add concentration and a certain energetic effort to that, and you turn eyes open, eyes closed. It doesn't really matter, but it's more of an inside job, even though there are external forms of meditation. But that's just really briefly, that would be the main distinction that I would place on it. Mindfulness, internal and external. Meditation, returning, and many things can unfold.
Anyone would like to add something, or maybe a little bit small variation there, Paul? If you just open your mic. Yes.
Yeah, Miles came up with an excellent definition there, the difference between meditation and mindfulness. What I would add would be that specifically mindfulness, the four things that I think of as being the quintessential mindfulness experience that we pay attention to is the body, are the body, the thoughts, the emotions, and the breath. The key with mindfulness to me has always been this concept of being disconnected through stress, which is one of the reasons why I think mindfulness kind of entered through the door of stress reduction from Jon Kabat-Zinn's program. It became really, really popular as a stress reduction program. And beginning with that, and of course, morphing out into many, many different areas, including leadership and business and so forth. But the key with the stress experience is what I've found is we have a tendency when we get stuck in that stress response, in that fight or flight response, we have a tendency to get stuck there for long periods of time. And because of that, the main coping mechanism that we use when we go into that fight, flight, or freeze mode is our ability to disconnect. So, of course, what do we disconnect from? We disconnect from our body, our thoughts, our emotions, and our breath. And the problem there is if we're disconnected, we really don't know that we're disconnected. And so this can go on for years and years. I have many people in my classes who discover through the practice of mindfulness that they've been disconnected, stuck in fight or flight or freeze for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And so what mindfulness does is it's sort of like the antidote to that disconnection where we lose contact with the ability to communicate with our body, thoughts, emotions, and breath. So if you think of the quintessential definition of mindfulness, paying attention moment by moment to the body, the thoughts, the emotions, and the breath, what you're doing there is you're actually reversing that disconnection. At that point, it's as if the body senses that we're reconnecting to it. And at that, it's sort of like an all clear indication to the body that there's no more threat out there. And so what happens at that point is the body itself shifts the autonomic nervous system out of the fight or flight mode. And the whole system begins to normalize, get into balance, and sync up once again. And so that's why mindfulness is so effective as a stress program and beyond. You know, once we can get our nervous systems, particularly the autonomic nervous system, back in balance, we can then begin the journey of mindfulness as far as getting into these flow states and experiencing these flow states in all of the different ways that we can experience them. In sports, in any kind of performance sector, in business, in the schools, everywhere you can imagine, we can have that present moment experience 24/7 and be in those flow states once we begin, when we achieve that sort of balanced nervous system. Thank so that's you. What I would add to Miles' excellent description of the difference between mindfulness and meditation.
Thank you, Paul. Shili, do you have maybe anything to add there?
Yeah, in terms of stress as it relates to organizations, you know, we all deal with stress, whether it's in our family lives or our organizations or our companies or whatever. And there is a certain level of what's considered optimal stress, and that improves performance. I mean, that's a good thing. Think of athletes. You know, you have to undergo stress to really expand and become better. But what happens is if that demand or stress that is, you know, creating a better performance is, you know, experienced over a prolonged period of time, it becomes detrimental, right? So think of like soldiers that are, you know, have those demands on them all the time. What happens is you lose attention span, you make errors. I mean, there are a lot of vulnerabilities with that prolonged kind of stress. So I think meditation and mindfulness in particular, but there are over 5,000 kinds of meditation that have been practiced since ancient times. And I think there are only about a dozen of them that have, you know, that we actually have research around. You know, I mean, most of us like research, right? And so I think maybe there are 7,000 studies or more now, but that's still in its infancy, you know? So the mindfulness piece is great. I think it's a foundation for meditation. And it's a great way to start to pay attention to your level of stress. And when it becomes too much and being able to notice that as just specifically the stress, I think that's, you know, I think that's a wonderful thing that anybody can use, but in particular in, you know, when we're working, when we do undergo a lot of stress.
Thank you, Shili. Flea, do you have anything from your side?
Well, yeah. My colleagues have covered it pretty well. One distinction might be, I mean, the words are used almost interchangeably these days often, but we could think of mindfulness more as a capacity. Of course, it can be a practice, but meditation is clearly a practice. I think it's important to remember, especially when we're introducing mindfulness out in the world, that it is an innate human capacity we all have. There's many different scientific tests that are the basis of the research that Shelley mentioned, that measure our kind of default level of mindfulness. And nobody would score zero on a test. That's impossible. We couldn't function without mindfulness. So it's an innate capacity we have. And the good news is we know that through practice, you can increase the state of mindfulness in the moment, but you can also create, raise the baseline. You can increase your default mindfulness and have it stay there, become stable at a higher level. So, and mindfulness is one of the specific components of various meditation practices. And it's really, I mean, again, it's been used in a lot of ways. Sometimes in meditation, we make a distinction between mindfulness and awareness. And mindfulness has to do with more with one-pointed attention, focus, concentration, and awareness, sometimes more of a panoramic capacity, which is also innate to the human mind. And so in that way, mindfulness sometimes is the doorway into more profound states of awareness, because mindfulness has to do with stabilizing the mind and stabilizing our attention. And it has to do with thinking about it neurobiologically, that shift from the default mode network, the very noisy discursive part of our brain, to the task positive network. And through that stabilization of attention, we then get access to innate states of awareness. So that's two ways you could maybe distinguish mindfulness and meditation.
Great, thank you. Now I might take, you know, on purpose, critical position that I've heard many times when I was working with in corporate sector, which is like, okay, it's great, but I don't have time for it. So what would you say around this idea? What would convince a leader to take time to either meditate or to be more mindful? Miles?
Yeah, I mean, not just leaders, you know, have a hard time finding time for it, but parents and just anybody, everybody. I would say that you know, traditionally the reason to practice meditation was for some type of spiritual liberation. That was the purpose that what people would come to find peace, calmness, whatever, but also to somehow transcend the difficulties that they may be facing in life. We have pretty good lives here in the West these days, so it's not that we're trying to find some type of spiritual liberation, but I think most people come to it for certainly in the West, like Shelley and Paul were speaking about, to really find some type of balance and stress reduction. And certainly leaders or people in any level of organization realize that the organizational stress does have long-term detrimental effects, like Shelley was saying. So in that sense, a really basic mindfulness, it just takes a few moments, a few seconds, a few minutes a day. And if you see, you put a little bit of effort in, you'll get a little bit of benefit. Mindfulness is beneficial in all things. Mindfulness is helpful in all times, all places, and all circumstances. That's a universal, principle. It's the core of all of our, certainly in Buddhism, it's the core. But in terms of meditation, I would say it depends on what you want. You know, like I say, most leaders are not really looking for some type of spiritual meditation. Perhaps they are, perhaps they're not. Spiritual liberation, perhaps they are, perhaps they're not. However, what I would say is that as a leader, unless you're just trying to maintain things as they are, which I don't really consider that, my own personal definition of a leader is not really that they're leading something forward. There's an evolving, growing understanding towards complexity and wholeness of certain, or certainly reaching the goals that you might have in your organization. If you really want to have impact in that type of intervention, it is 100% determined by the interior of the intervener. And that's where certainly mindfulness for sure, but meditation takes you into deeper and deeper and deeper aspects of who you are, not to discover who you are.
Thank you. I'm going to switch a little bit. Maybe Shelley, would you like to add something?
Sure. I mean, most of the people I work with have some sort of practice, and that's why they come to me. But for those people who say, I don't have the time because I'm too busy and I'm, you know, whatever, there are a bunch of things that may seem simple that I request of them, demand of them, actually, that actually they say help. So paying attention to your breath anytime. So if you're anxious, breathe with a longer exhale, 3 breaths, that's it, just 3 breaths, just do that. Pay attention to it, longer exhale. If you're feeling depressed and fatigued, take a few more hyperventilative breaths, you know, really get some oxygen to your brain. If when you get in the car in the morning to drive off, let the ignition, you know, put the keys in the ignition, let the car warm up and take a few breaths and pay attention to them. Also, honestly, when you're bathing, I mean, just really being embodied when you're, you know, taking care of yourself. And the thing that I've come to in the 20 some years since I had my son, where I don't sleep through the night, rather than becoming anxious about, oh, I'm going to be tired tomorrow, and you know, why can't I fall asleep? What I've done is embrace that time to just pay attention to the breath, to empty the self as much as possible and be still. It's quiet anyway. And so I embrace that time. So I'm often up sometime between 2 or 4, and I use it as a meditative time. And it also has an interesting effect on dreams when you do that. The other thing I do, and because there's so many different kinds of meditation, I mean, honestly, I think mindfulness is, well, I mean, really mindfulness is just one of the Eightfold Path that Buddhism was, you know, that MBSR was derived from, right? I mean, there's 7 other aspects to the path, right? Right speech and right understanding and right action and right livelihood and concentration. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like having a meditative gratitude practice. So, you know, before you go to bed, and there are studies, and I put some in my notes in terms of the research that I'm talking about. When participants have been instructed to visualize before they go to bed, something that they feel, 3 things actually, that they felt grateful for that happened that day. Not just a thought, not just some idealized version of what would be good, but some visualization of something that happened that not only does after, I think maybe 27 days or 20 some days, it improves sleep, it improves mood, and it also changes neurology. So, I mean, you know, there are lots of ways to skin a cat, if you will.
Thank you, Shelley. Paul, do you have anything?
Yeah, let me take a shot at this. To directly answer your question, Stephanie, somebody says to me, I don't have time for this. You know, a leader wants to bring it into his group, and the group is saying, well, I don't have time for this stuff. Well, the first question I would ask them is, what do you know about this? And the first answer that they would have for me is, what's in it for me? When I go into a group, whether it's a school or a business or a hospital or any kind of group, the first thing that these people want to know is, what's in it for me? And once they're convinced that there's something in it for them, and there's something, you know, everybody has different goals, and you need to pretty much cover all those broad goals and make a connection between what the mindfulness practice can do to help you achieve your goals. And once people start to realize that this is what's in it for you, magically, they have more time to spend to do some practice. It's like magic. As soon as they understand what this process is all about and what it could do for them, they have time. And so unless you're in a situation like a school, and I oversee the curriculum for Inner Explorer, which is a nonprofit mindfulness in the schools program, and we're in front of well over 1 million kids now in the United States. And unless you're in a situation like that, where the teacher simply does the 8 to 10 minute practice every day with the kids, and it's sort of mandated, although the kids pick up on it really quickly and love it. But if you're not in a situation like that, it becomes what's in it for me, and they need to know what's in it for them. And like I said, before you know it, they've got time to do a little bit of practice, number one. Number two, there's a large part of mindfulness that doesn't involve practice at all. You do it in full stride of your particular life, you know. So the example would be, you take this present moment attention, this present moment awareness, and you bring it into the experience of walking or talking and communicating or brushing your teeth or eating a meal. That takes no time at all. That just takes remembering to bring that level of attention into your everyday experience.
Thank you, Paul. Fleet, would you have anything to answer if I say I don't have time for that?
Well, I hear this a lot from busy professionals and parents, or parent professionals who are also parents and so on, that I work with. And like both Shelley and Paul said, we can integrate mindfulness into any activity, any human activity. And obviously that's the goal, where we do a formal mindfulness practice really to fuel that transition of mindfulness into all of our activities. And yet just suggesting to someone, well, you can be mindful while you're walking, you be mindful while you're washing the dishes, you can be mindful when you're brushing your teeth is great. But do we remember to do that? Do we remember to do that? Do we recognize how distracted we are and actually take on those activities as a practice? So most people have found that if you have some kind of formal practice, you're more likely to do those things. But having said that, you can take on anything as a practice with intentionality. So I often encourage that, but I think the thing that has the most immediate uptake I find for people, Shelley mentioned it, is working with their breath and just bringing mindfulness to the breath, because it's already there, it's happening all the time. And people get an immediate payoff. I mean, just taking one nice long deep breath, especially if it's a diaphragmatic or belly breath, mindfully, it's just like pressing the reset button on our nervous system. And people experience an immediate payoff for that. And they go, oh, that felt good. That works. I'm going to keep doing that. So I teach a lot of breath regulation techniques of all kinds. And they get a very quick uptake because they're easy to do. You can do them anytime, anywhere. And people get an immediate payoff. One of the other factors, though, I often hear from people that I think combines with people saying they're too busy, I don't have time, is that they've tried sitting mindfulness practice or some kind of traditional mindfulness practice, and they found it hard. They found it boring. They found their mind was too busy, so they couldn't settle. And I think, you know, traditionally, a lot of the classic instruction was just go sit and work it out yourself, figure it out, right? And, you know, that may be all right if you have 20 years to dedicate to it, but I actually think it's much kinder to give people really good instruction, good technique, and good methodology. And what I really emphasize in my teaching is deep embodiment, because again, that connection between in our brain, the neural networks in our brain, the default mode network, which is that very busy discursive part of the brain that's active when we don't direct our attention, and then the task positive or executive network, which engages when we do direct our attention, and the fact that they're mutually inhibitory. So to the extent that we synchronize body and mind in some way and engage ourselves with something, the busy part of the mind naturally quiets down. So when I give people instruction where they can much more quickly move into deeper embodiment and establish the body as a deep anchor for their practice, anchoring them in nowness, and really understanding more about their autonomic nervous system and how that works, and understanding about this switch from the neural pathways, that we can actually develop kind of an internal neurobiofeedback system and actually feel that shift. And when people get that experience, they it's really tremendously empowering. And they feel like, okay, I could sit down for 5 minutes and actually create a shift, right? Because that's what, you know, we're kind of looking for. We want to shift our state into recovery mode to heal from stress, or we just want to, you know, get out of some not so resource state into a more optimal state to engage in whatever we're doing. So if people can get quick results, they're much more likely to feel they have the time. And I think one of the best ways to give people quicker results is to give them really good, clear technique with an emphasis on embodiment.
Thank you. Thank you, Fleet. That actually led me to the question I wanted to ask, and someone asked it in the Q&A. What would you recommend someone who wants to learn and never practiced start with, meditation or mindfulness? Shelley?
I think it really depends on context and culture. I mean, you could do Christian contemplative centering prayer, or, you know, I mean, there are just so many ways and to practice it. Starting with the breath is the easiest, as everyone else has said, and I probably everyone on this entire summit has talked about. I mean, it's there. to work with, and it's the one thing that we can control. I mean, we can actually trick our nervous systems into thinking we're relaxed by long exhales, you know, so we can do that consciously. And so, you know, it depends. It's like if it's somebody who's wanting to bring mindfulness, let's say, into the work environment, I think if it's a leader, let's just say somebody who sets mission and roles, make it part of the ethics of the corporation, right, or the company, or the volunteer organization, whatever it is, so that a couple things. I mean, and if I can just, you know, this is a little bit detailed about how it can benefit anyone, especially a group. It's like when meditation, one of the things, the main thing that you first get in touch with is feelings and sensations. And one of my criticisms of some of the meditation practices that are out there is that they sort of stop there. And feelings are not facts, you know? I mean, we don't want to swirl around in feelings. And I think sometimes, especially with people who suffer with depression or major ruminators, like it's not a complete picture. And so being able to also drop into, okay, what am I feeling? And what are the unmet needs that are causing those feelings, right? And then being able to also see that my colleague or my coworker also has different feelings and needs, and being sort of open to understand that, to talk about it, to, you know, I mean, really to be able to discern those needs and go to your colleagues or boss even, and to, with dignity and humility, ask for what you want. You know, skillfully, with and I would say a kind tone of voice, which I think is absolutely critical and completely underappreciated at all levels of society. I mean, just how much that matters to be congruent with what you're saying and how you're speaking and how it sounds. And so, I think if you're developing a practice that is not just beyond breathing, beyond noticing the feelings and sensations, you're actually invoking something that is active as well. I think that's where it really makes a difference. And I think in corporate situations or any kind of volunteer organizations, whatever, I think if that is part of the ethos and people understand that they can be safe revealing, let's say, if they made a mistake. You know, most people kind of cover it up and conceal their errors and withdraw and, you know, sort of leave the team privately, right? But if there's something that is it's part of the organization where they're saying, no, we want to be transparent. Tell us what's going on. Share your vulnerabilities and let's all find ways to help, right? That totally changes not only the conversations that happen and the productivity and the capacity to get, you know, sell your widgets or do your service, you know, meet your clients' needs, but it also makes your work environment so much more enjoyable, you know? I've worked for two universities and currently and in my prior life, and there was so much underground insecurities and gossiping instead of being straight with people, and there was no place for that to actually be worked through. It just doesn't happen. It's not part of the way we do business. And so to me, being able to with meditation, see your feelings, discern your needs, be able to communicate it. If you can't communicate it, if the person or boss is unreachable, find ways within yourself to manage whatever you're dealing with and bring your best self to whatever situation you're facing.
Usually. Anything you would like to add
Okay, so here's the thing. The question was, do you start with meditation or mindfulness? My answer would be mindfulness without a doubt. And I base that on about 50 years of experience of teaching various forms of meditation in addition to mindfulness. One of the most important things that I learned over the past 50 years in teaching various types of meditation is that many people who come to the practice of meditation are in that condition that I spoke about before, where they're disconnected. They're maybe stuck in that fight or flight mode to a little bit or a lot or just in the middle. And so what happens is they get into meditation. They're already disconnected. And what happens is, depending upon the meditation that they're practicing, they can become even more disconnected. And so what I see from an image point of view, I see a wagon wheel. And all the different spokes on the wagon wheel represent the different kinds of meditation. And there are so many of them. But the hub of the wheel is mindfulness, because mindfulness is what's going to reconnect you, bring you back into your body. It'll create embodiment, which, by the way, would be a great title for your conference. So anyway, what I've seen over all those years is that so many people, through the various forms of meditation, still don't make that connection to their bodies. They sort of are interested in these altered states, shall we say. And there's a lot to be said for that kind of practice. But if I was really going to run a school where I was teaching all those different kinds of meditation and mindfulness, I would start them off with the mindfulness, get them in their bodies first. And once they're embodied, then start introducing the various meditation approaches that can bring you into these different states of awareness and consciousness. And like I said, I've done that for many, many years, and it's great stuff. But if you're not in your body first, it can kind of throw you off center. So for sure, my vote would be, let's do mindfulness first and then move into whatever form of meditation you happen to be drawn to. Lots of great ones out there.
Thank you. Fleet, anyone, anything you want to add?
I find it a little bit of a difficult question because I don't really separate mindfulness and meditation all that much. I think they're mindfulness, I think, as Paul was saying, is foundational to meditation altogether. And I can't imagine what a non-mindfulness meditation practice would be. And types of meditation that aren't connected to the body, I think, are mostly head trips. I don't know that it's if we're not really embodied, if we're not awake, you know, if our whole physiological and emotional and cognitive, it's a holistic system. And if we're not awake to that, I think it's really hard to say that we're actually practicing any kind of meditation, whatever the method is. So, you know, I think it's, where do you begin? It's by, you know, just meeting people where they're at. And again, having simple, clear techniques that people can easily do and that they're likely to do, and that they're going to get relatively immediate results from, so they're going to want to keep doing it, right? But we seem to be mostly talking about how would we introduce, you know, as leaders, how would we introduce the practice, or what practice might we offer? I'm curious to actually talk about being mindful leaders, and what that is, because for me that's really the key. And I actually think there's a fair number of leaders out there introducing mindfulness into their companies who are not mindfulness practitioners themselves, which is kind of ironic. So you know, I think it's really, to me, the biggest benefit is for leaders themselves to embrace the practice of mindfulness, because, you know, what do we need from our leaders? We need leaders who really show up as their best self and as awake, present, compassionate, kind beings who can hold safety and create environments where others can thrive and accomplish. So, you know, I'd be curious if we might begin to explore what it actually means for a leader to be mindful.
And I can add to that, just, I won't repeat what everybody else said, because, you know, why would I do that? But if we just look at it organizationally, mindfulness basically just raises awareness in the field. And if it's being introduced into an organization and it's kind of collectively being taken on, you know, if there's a buy-in for everybody, regardless of how much they're able to be mindful or not, you know, we're all going through what we're going through. That means that we're putting it in the middle. We're putting it in the center of our activities. That we are organizing around awareness. We're organizing around mindfulness. And at that point, I think Shelley was touching on, you know, just how much more functional things become. How much more all those kind of unspoken things that everybody, if you're sensitive, well, you're certainly, you're at the effect of it for sure. But if you're aware, you kind of see it going on, but nobody's speaking about it. When you put awareness in the middle, when you put mindfulness in the middle, these types of things, productivity things or interrelational, interpersonal, unspoken issues start to kind of, they get lit up. And if, and of course, this is where Fleet was talking about, that the leader needs to go first. If the leader is not buying into this, then it doesn't matter how much everybody else in the organization is working on mindfulness. They may be getting personal benefit, but in terms of a systemic benefit, I just think that it's going to always fall flat if the leader's not missing themselves. Implementing.
Can I add something to that, Miles?
Yeah, sure.
I really appreciate what you're saying, because in my work, especially in my consulting work, I find that it is very rare that leaders are truly observing their own limitations and their shadow side. They're basically busy fostering a persona and have been doing it their whole lives, creating their identities and, you know, cultivating, a persona of knowledge and power and strength. And, like, of course, there are exceptions like Gandhi and Mandela and MLK and, you know, but largely, and it's not just leaders. I mean, it's a group collective where there is not a dedication to in the mindfulness, whether it's formal or not, that people are actually aware of their vulnerabilities. You know, I mean, we've got our Z generation that are spending hours Photoshopping images for Instagram. Nobody's saying, gee, you know, yesterday I was really selfish with my sister, or, you know, I'm worried about how vain I am, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, that's not being addressed. And I think that's actually, I mean, I know I'm coming from the psychotherapeutic standpoint, but that's the healing. And I think it starts at the top, and I don't want to, you know, it starts at the top where people are really looking at what's happening in their own lives first. And once you do that, you know, some humility arises, right? And then you feel more compassionate, not only for yourself, because you're not perfect and you're human like everybody else, but I think people are more willing to listen to others and receive it in a compassionate way and be embodied in their presence with connecting with others when they're having difficulty. I mean, everyone can be like, you know, let's bring our best self to this. Yeah, well, the best self also includes a hell of a lot of shadow for everybody. And that doesn't get addressed enough in my humble opinion, so.
Thank you, Shelley. We getting really quick close to the time. So I have a question, and it's a question I indirectly asked to Miles some time ago. And it's a different type of leaders that can be moms, or that can be maybe not like the top leader, the way we used to see it, is for people who put other people's first. So that's when I say like a mom or the type of function of leaders wouldn't take the time to maybe be mindful or do meditation. What would you suggest them to motivate them to practice? Does that make sense?
Could you rephrase that, Stephanie?
Yes, I would say that if it's a leader that it's in the front of the field, you ask this leader to do a certain work for himself and he would do it. But when you have a type of people who put others first and then the themselves last, there's never a time for meditate. There's never a time they're taking for themselves to be mindful or do meditation. So what would you suggest for this type of people?
So somebody who puts other people before themselves.
Take a mom. A mom will do like, yeah. we wake up like at 6 a.m. Okay. Because of the young child, you know, wakes up and then like spend the whole day for others. And then it's just too tired to meditate. So what would you suggest there?
Yeah, well, I would emphasize the importance of taking care of oneself first, which then allows us to be much more effective in taking care of others. If you're taking care of others to the expense of yourself, then not only are you creating problems for yourself, but you're creating, frankly, problems for the ones that you're taking care of. So I would emphasize that, you know, take care of yourself first. You know, in the field of compassion, we would be focusing in on self-compassion first. In the loving kindness practice, that's where we go first. We bring the compassion to oneself. And then we spread it out to everyone and everything, everywhere. So I would bring that to that person's attention. And then I think naturally what would happen is once they're able to begin with themselves, then those leadership qualities, and you know, I'm sort of broadening out from the moms, but I wanted to get back a little bit to organizations and leadership and so forth and so on. And it's true that a lot of leaders of organizations don't embody that present moment awareness, but I've owned a fair number of businesses myself. And whenever I work with the employees that I've got in my businesses, my goal is always to teach them mindfulness qualities and leadership qualities themselves. So I'm looking for everybody in my business, every employee in my business, to become a leader. And so in teaching the employees mindfulness in that way, what I've discovered is just through that natural process of embodiment and present moment awareness, those qualities of leadership that we all value so much, they bubble up to the surface and become a very easy expression just through the natural course of the practice. So these qualities that we all value so much in a leader and other qualities as well, I mean, compassion and kindness and appreciation and gratitude and the ability to communicate and critical thinking, imagination and creativity, all of those qualities are within us already. And so once we're able to establish that practice and start reducing the fear, then those qualities begin to bubble up to the surface naturally. They're natural byproducts of embodiment. And so if I may just briefly use one image that I really like, and it's an image that John F. Kennedy, when he was president, came up with. And he wasn't looking to describe mindfulness, but he was looking to create a new economic philosophy for the country. And his theory was if he could create an economic, a broad economic policy for the country, then everybody would benefit. And so he came up with this now famous saying, which is a rising tide lifts all boats. And I heard that the other day and I said, you know what? I know Kennedy didn't mean it that way, But to me, that's a great image for mindfulness, because mindfulness could be the rising tide. The boats could represent the kindness, compassion, you know, critical thinking, imagination, creativity, a sense of calm and embodiment and so forth and so on. Those would be the boats. So that rising tide of mindfulness will naturally lift all boats. So once again, my experience has been, and I've seen it with the many students that I've worked with, is those qualities emerge naturally as a byproduct of the practice. And so I thank John F. Kennedy for that image, because it's been really meaningful to me. And I've started to share it with other people, and they find that the image is excellent as well. So thank you for letting me share Kennedy's famous saying.
Thank you. We have 3 minutes left. So is there anyone who would like to add anything on this?
I'd just like to say briefly that there's many different levels of mindfulness and meditation and so forth. And it's beneficial at every level. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about mindfulness. It's fairly simple, straightforward, benign, and beneficial at every level. But what we really need, I think what people who are within the sphere of influence of leaders need, but also what the world needs from leaders right now, is a real shift in consciousness. And so, you know, I think finding ways to invite leaders into deep practice and deep embodiment, because, you know, it's by being really deeply embodied and awake to the body that we also get in touch with the emotional body, and we're in touch with what we're feeling. We're willing to feel. We have a culture that's not willing to feel. And when we're willing to feel, we can get in touch with our underlying needs and so forth, and develop that empathic consciousness with ourselves and with others, and really shift to a consciousness where we're more focused on the good of the whole than only our own selfish aims. And I think we desperately need that shift of consciousness from leaders. And I think, skillfully introduce mindfulness and mindfulness-based emotional intelligence training and so forth is a pathway to that kind of transformation for our leaders today.
Thank you.
Amen to that, Fleet. Yeah. Very well said. Very well said.
Anything that you would like to add, Shili?
I just feel introspective or contemplative practices are absolutely key to reflecting a world that will care for everyone alive. I mean, it's painfully obvious to me that everyone deserves a chance to survive and thrive. And to me, that's the true reason for meditation.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I'm totally in alignment with Shelley there. I would say mindfulness goes very broad. Meditation goes very deep, and it actually transforms, shapes the mind, as the Buddha said, which we know from neuroscience is another way to say that our brains also change.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you four on this panel. Before we finish, we always ask each speaker your top tip for embodiment. So, if you can make it just short, like couple of sentences max, what would be your top tip for embodiment? Paul?
I'll make it real short. My answer would be mindfulness practice.
That's easy. Fleet, would you have anything? Top tip for embodiment?
Well, I think it's just really bringing the embodiment focus to mindfulness practice, to realize that our entire body is sensory, all the way down to the bones. It's all living tissue, all contains neuronal cells. Even the marrow of the bones has neuronal cells. So we're feeling beings, and I don't think there's any limit to how deep our interoceptive awareness can go. And I think that's the project of a lifetime. And the more deeply connected we become with the body, as I said before, we're more connected with our emotional body and even the subtle energy body. So that's what I would say, is just really getting that focus on deep embodiment and realizing that it's almost like the unexplored frontier. It's the next frontier.
Thank you, Fleet. Shelley? What would be a top tip for embodiment?
I would suggest that people in between meetings or before going on a phone call or anytime they have the awareness to do a deep forward bend and breathe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's what I do.
I will try it. Miles, what would be a top tip for embodiment?
Yeah, I would say just shortly that embodiment, like meditation, is an inside job.
Well done. Thank you. Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you, all the participants, for watching this session. Just to let you know, before we close, that you can watch this session for the next 48 hours. We will have a lot of other panels. As you know, we have a full channel on meditation and a full channel on leadership. So if you would like to see again and digest all our session, you can upgrade your participation. And by the library of the conference, I believe it has a special price for today and for the next few days. So if you want to learn more about embodiment, this is the place. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Paul, Shili, Fleet, and Miles. It has been a pleasure to be with you, and looking forward to see you again.
Thank you, Stephanie.
You're welcome, Stephanie. Good job.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you.